Session number 12778.
General Martin, Reel 18.
I said that in the early days there was nothing illegal about shouting slogans or putting up posters. But in July 1967, legislation was passed by the Hong Kong government making the posting of inflammatory posters illegal. This action was taken because posters calling for the overthrow of the Hong Kong British and with slogans such as Kill Trench, Trench being the governor of Hong Kong, were appearing all over over Hong Kong, displayed on buses and trams, and indeed all over the railing surrounding Government House. Some such posters had been on display in the border for 5 months or so. Most were written in Chinese and were therefore incomprehensible to my soldiers, although they could certainly be read by our Chinese police and by our own civilians living in the border area. The new law said that inflammatory posters were illegal, but none of us were quite clear what inflammatory meant. The legal ruling was that the contents of posters must be such as to inflame the emotions of anyone who read them. But I felt that the only people likely to be inflamed by the posters on the border were the people who put them up. However, laws are laws, and the people who execute them are the police. And so, without even bothering to inform us, the police started to pull them down. And on the night of the 2nd of August, they pulled down a number of posters which had been stuck up on Lo Wu Bridge. On the morning of the 3rd of August, the Chinese farmers coming across to work on our side saw that their posters had been ripped down and became violently excited. Reinforced by gangs of hooligans, they then attempted to batter their way into the immigration compound at Lo Wu and to get at the Gurkha soldiers and civilian officials inside. They used stones, bricks and crowbars. The company commander of the 1st 10th Gurkha Rifles on the spot decided to try and disperse them by a show of force. And the very appearance of soldiers is often sufficient to disperse an unlawful assembly, and that's the very best example of the use of minimum force. At the appearance of a platoon of Gurkha soldiers, the crowd did disperse for a short time, but were soon back in even greater strength. The company commander then ordered his soldiers to draw their kukris and to charge down the railway line towards the bridge with blood-curdling cries. This again had an immediate but short-lived effect. The crowd came rushing back over the bridge and started a barrage of bricks and stones against the soldiers. Company commander decided the time had come to use gas. And in the summer months in Hong Kong, a prevailing wind blows from south to north. And on this occasion, therefore, the gas was very effective. It blew straight down the funnel of the railway line. And when it affected the Chinese army sentries, who had no respirators, they called the mob back. And an uneasy peace was to lay on Lo Wu for the next 3 weeks. Well, I thought we'd done really quite well, but it was not long before the acting political advisor was on the telephone, asking me whether it had really been necessary to use gas, and whether I appreciated the very serious political repercussions that were likely to follow this use of force against citizens of another nation at the main international crossing point, and particularly as the gas had blown into Chinese territory. And I said I fully realised the implications, but I had no hesitation whatsoever in using the gas and saying that it had been necessary to do so. And of course anything one did up on the border became an international situation straight away. Now, we were trying very hard to avoid any escalation of the situation on the border, And my talks on the telephone to the acting political advisor made it even more clear that we got to lean over backwards to avoid offensive action if we could possibly help it. And that factor was to influence us very considerably in the following days. On the night of the 4th of August, undeterred by the consequences of their removal of posters at Lo Wu, and again without prior consultation, the police removed a number of posters, some inflammatory, some containing the thoughts of Chairman Mao, from the neighbourhood of Mankam To Bridge. At the end of the bridge, on our side, was a small police post, normally occupied by about six Hong Kong policemen. Because of the policy we had adopted of avoiding escalation, there was only one soldier on view near the bridge, and he was a ceremonial sentry. But a platoon of Gurkha soldiers was in a concealed post on the hilltop about 200 yards back from the border. On the morning of the 5th of August, the soldiers, the coolies who crossed the bridge daily with vegetables on trolleys for loading on our side onto the lorries, came across as usual. There were about 50 of them. As they entered the market area, they saw that their posters had been pulled down. They stopped, had a quiet talk together, and then turned round as if to march back across the bridge into China. As they drew level with our police posts and ceremonial sentry, they suddenly jumped them and disarmed them. These coolies carried sort of great meat hooks, which were absolutely lethal weapons, and they weren't just disarmed, so to speak. One policeman managed to get a message back on the police radio, and at that particular moment I was at the nearby police station at Taku Ling. I just commented to the company commander there that everything seemed pretty peaceful when the police inspector rushed up onto the roof where we were standing to say that his police post at Mankam To had been overrun. Ronnie McAllister, the CO of the 1st 10th Gurkha Rifles, was away for the morning, and so I gave the company commander orders to move at once with his reserve platoon and restore the situation at the bridge. I couldn't give him any clearer orders because I had no idea what he was going to find when he got there. It seemed to me possible at that moment that the policeman and soldier might have been carried across the bridge into China or even shot. But the company commander, Major Chris Pike, was a first-class soldier who had just earned a very good DSO in Borneo and who had a very shrewd and sensible mind as well. And so, having told my headquarters on the radio what was happening and what orders I'd given, and having told them to dispatch a troop of armed cars up to Mankam To as soon as possible, I then went down to the bridge myself. I went initially up to the top of a little hill just behind it, and peering down, I was astonished to see Major Pike and his soldiers sitting on the edge of the pavement by the bridge, smoking cigarettes, while the 50 coolies with their captured weapons stood and talked to him. I think in retrospect it was very stupid, but I then decided to go down to the bridge myself. And for the next 3 hours, I had the experience of trying to carry out a logical discussion with people to whom logic is entirely meaningless. I took with me a police sergeant major who acted as my interpreter, and I started by asking the coolies what the trouble was. And they said that someone had taken their posters down, and they had certain demands which had got to be met. And their demands were that whoever took the posters down had got to be punished. We must promise never to take their posters down again. And we must promise there would be no reprisals for what they'd done in seizing the weapons from our policeman and soldier. and they must be allowed to sing their songs, chant the thoughts of Ma, and work at peace. Well, I said we were certainly not going to punish anyone for taking down the posters, because the inflammatory posters were against the law. I said that if I went into China, surely they would expect me to obey the law. And they said, yes, they would certainly expect me to obey their law. And I said, in that case, when they came to work in Hong Kong, they must obey the law of Hong Kong. And they said, how could they be expected to know what the laws of Hong Kong were? So I said, if they didn't know the laws of Hong Kong, I'd have somebody down at Mangkum Tow the next morning to explain what the relevant laws were. They said they didn't want to know what the laws of Hong Kong were. And they went back again to demanding the punishment of whoever took the poster down. And I said that I was certainly not going to punish anyone for obeying the law. So they then switched to promise number two, and that we must promise never take down their posters again. Well, before we could start an argument on that one, I decided to counterattack. So I said through my police son, major interpreter, don't you study the thoughts of Chairman Mao? And they said, of course they did, and they were very indignant about this. So I said, why had they not obeyed the thoughts of Chairman Mao? And they looked uneasily at each other and asked what they had disobeyed. So I said, Chairman Mao's thoughts say that you must never harm anyone first. So why had they attacked the policeman and the Gurkha soldier? And they looked a bit nonplussed for a moment, and then said the sentries had pointed their weapons at them. And all the rest chimed in and said, yes, the sentries pointed their weapons at us. I said that was nonsense, and they knew it. But having got them a bit upset, I then drew their attention to another of Chairman Mao's thoughts in his little red book. He says in the book that if you do damage, you must pay for it. And I pointed to all the broken tiles on the roof of the police post, which had been broken by stone throwers, and said, who's going to pay for this damage? And one of them said the damage had been done by children, and they had no control over their children. I said, you've got to get control over your children. How can you expect your children to grow up to follow the thoughts of Chairman Mao if your children have no discipline? Well, by this time everything had quietened down, and they were all looking a bit sheepish. And we had a break when two coolies appeared across the bridge wheeling large tea buckets on trolleys. And so we had a tea break. And I asked them during the tea break why their posters were so important to them. And they said that they were the thoughts of Chairman Mao and acted as an inspiration to them when they were working. And they all worked far harder if from time to time they could look at a poster and read the inspiring thoughts written on it. And for that reason they must be permitted to put up their posters on our territory, which was where they actually worked. So with my tongue in my cheek, I said, if we permitted them to put up their posters on our territory, then surely it would only be fair if we could put up our posters on their territory. And they seemed to think that was sensible. But one man was dispatched back across the bridge to get official guidance. And he came back to say, unfortunately, it was not all right for us to put up our posters on Chinese territory because we didn't work there. And so there was no need for us to have our inspiring thoughts over there. I then asked why they put up inflammatory posters on our side and why they'd attack the policeman and soldier. And they said they'd been given orders to support their compatriots in Hong Kong against the British oppressors. So I pointed to the Gurkha soldiers sitting around smoking cigarettes and sipping their tea and said, did they look like oppressors? I said, do you realise that if we had been oppressors, we would have shot you all straight away as soon as you attacked us? And I then said, Did they realize that there were fewer people in Hong Kong in prison that very day than there had been before the trouble started? Well, they said they didn't believe this, and I didn't really believe it either, but it had been in the morning paper that morning. So I then offered to take any two of them in my staff car for a trip into Hong Kong, so that they could see for themselves that the people in Hong Kong were not oppressed people. And this was obviously a very tempting offer, but after a 7-month discussion, I think because they couldn't decide who should go, they declined it. So I then referred again to the inflammatory posters, and I pointed to one and said, I'm told that this poster says, kill all the Hong Kong British. I said, do you want to kill me? And that was a tricky moment. But they said, no, they didn't want to kill me. So I said, well, why then put up posters saying that you do want to kill me? By this time, the discussion was really quite friendly. And I thought the time come to make a slight conciliatory gesture. So I said we had no objection, because it was not against the laws of Hong Kong, if they put up a reasonable number of posters in the compound bearing the thoughts of Chairman Mao. But to avoid any doubts in the future as to what they could put up, I insisted only the thoughts contained in the little red book could be used. And they said, well, Chairman Mao is always having new thoughts. Again, I insisted that only the thoughts in the book could be used, otherwise there could be misunderstandings in the future. One man then said that he had read somewhere in the book that the British were revisionists. Were they allowed to put up that thought? I said I had no idea what being a revisionist was, but if it was in the little red book, that was all right by me. And then I said, supposing on the walls of this police post we have posters bearing the thoughts of our great chairman, Harold Wilson, will you respect these posters, or will you put the thoughts of Chairman Mao over the top? And they said, of course they would respect the thoughts of our great chairman, Harold Wilson. Well, by now I'd been joined by the district officer, Trevor Bedford, and together we wrote out a statement outlining what they could and could not do when working on Hong Kong territory, and we handed this to one of their leaders. I then suggested we adopted the good old British custom of shaking hands on it. Whereupon they said, but we want your promise to punish whoever took the posters down. And so we started all over again. Eventually they accepted the statement we had written as being the end of the matter, handed back the weapons, and returned peacefully to work. Well, it seemed to me that what could have been a very nasty situation had been solved in a fairly common sense manner for that part of the world. But I was soon to be disabused when I got back to Brigade Headquarters. Shortly afterwards, the acting political advisor arrived by helicopter. Brigadier, he said, do you realise the appalling situation we are now in? I asked him what he meant, and he said, you have signed a treaty with Red China. However, this turned out to be all right, because the Chinese workers hadn't signed the bit of paper as well, and apparently treaties need signatures by both parties. So I then, rather crossly, said to the acting political adviser, what we need from you, chum, at once, are some posters bearing the thoughts of Harold Wilson. And he reeled back and said, but he hasn't had any. Well, he eventually sent some posters down, urging everyone to save water. But that was the nearest we got the thoughts of Harold Wilson. It was interesting to see the reactions in Hong Kong to what the press dubbed the Mangkhum Toe Tea Party. The Chinese and the old China hands thought we had achieved the best possible solution, but they felt that the Mangkhum Toe coolies, who were of course the Mangkhum Toe militia, would be getting a severe reprimand from their own side for having thrown away their temporary tactical advantage and for not getting any concessions in exchange. On the other hand, the hawks down in Hong Kong and Kowloon thought it was quite appalling that a bunch of coolies should have been allowed to disarm a policeman and a soldier and not have been shot or imprisoned as a result. I was personally quite sure we'd done the right thing, but it is very difficult to retain a cool judgment when you are accused either openly or behind your back by fellow officers of being thoroughly wet. A mention about the thoughts of our Chairman Harold, which got into the press, sparked the production by Gnome Press in UK of The Thoughts of Chairman Harold, which is produced in also a little red book. Well, for 4 days, the Mancomtove coolies behaved exceptionally well. They worked like beavers in the market, and although they marched smartly to and fro across the bridge, they held no prayer meetings and didn't even stick up posters of Chairman Mao's thoughts. But obviously they'd been given a reprimand for failing to achieve enough from the 4th of August, because as they went back to their own side on the evening of the 9th, they suddenly slapped a whole lot of new inflammatory posters all over the market compound and even on the wall of the police post. This was an act of defiance and such a clear breach of our agreement that I felt the posters had to come down. They were removed during the night, and at the same time, 1st 10th Gurkhan Rifles erected a Dannet wire fence round the police post so that the coolies couldn't get close enough to the building to put up more posters. The wire run the police post projected a couple of feet into the roadway along which the coolies had to manhandle their trolleys of vegetables, and I therefore instructed 69 Gurkha Independent Engineer Squadron to be prepared to replace the Dannet wire with a chain-link fence during the evening of the 10th of August. The coolies didn't come to work at the usual time next day. Instead, they could be seen at the far end of the bridge, pointing angrily towards the police post, from which their posters were conspicuously absent. During the morning, a representative of the Mandoon Transport Company, onto whose lorries vegetables and produce were loaded for movement down to Kowloon, went across the bridge into China to find out what had happened. When he came back, he reported that the coolies were extremely angry that their posters had been taken down and had said that the wire projecting into the roadway was dangerous and that if any of their vegetable trolleys ran into it, someone might get hurt. The Mandoon representative told us that he had suggested to them that he should inform the British authorities of the coolies' fears about the wire because the British, being fairly reasonable people, might well agree to adjust it. He was told that on no account was he to inform us. However, we did a quick survey of the line of the wire and moved it in slightly towards the building so that there couldn't be any question of it being an obstruction. At 2:15 that day, Colonel Ronnie McAllister, commanding the 1st 10th Gurkha Rifles, went down to the police post to visit his soldiers. Within the wire perimeter of the post, he had only a weak platoon of 15 men, of whom about 8 or 10 were brand new recruits who had only arrived 2 days previously. After the Mancomtove Tea Party, strict instructions had been given from above that no one above the rank of major was to risk involvement with Chinese farmers or coolies, and it was an unlucky chance, therefore, that Colonel McAllister happened to be in the police post when events suddenly started to move very fast indeed. As Colonel McAllister arrived at the post, the Chinese army suddenly stood to right along the border. They appeared in full battle order, with camouflage veils over their faces and twigs and foliage stuck into their equipment, and not only occupied their defensive positions, but moved down to the river bank itself. Admiral Recoilis' gun was brought up very close to the police post, our police post, and trained on it. Boxes of ammunition were brought forward to the gun, and the ammunition taken out of the boxes and piled beside it. It was very obvious that something was going to happen, and the question was, what? Well, we didn't have long to wait. At 2:30 p.m., five coolies marched across the bridge, walked round the market compound, and returned across the bridge. A recce party. Shortly afterwards, a trolley full of vegetables was pushed across the bridge by half a dozen men. It was pushed quite deliberately into the wire outside the police post, overturned into the roadway, and one member of the party then threw himself to the ground, screaming in simulated agony. His comrades lifted him up and carried him back across the bridge. It was a splendid theatrical performance. Within minutes, 50 or 60 coolies were lining the wire outside the police post, demanding the immediate punishment of those responsible for erecting the wire, compensation for their severely injured colleague, immediate removal of the wire, promises never to put up the wire again. It was a very hot day, and for the next 6 hours, the small garrison of the post, with Colonel McAllister still unfortunately there, had to remain on maximum alert, while relays of coolies shouted and screamed and yelled and chanted and tried from time to time to pull away the wire. During the course of the afternoon, we managed to introduce Trevor Bedford, the district officer, into the compound, he being an excellent Cantonese speaker and a respected person in that part of the world. And for hour after hour, he talked to the coolies across the wire and tried to calm them down. From time to time, he seemed to be having success. Cigarettes would be passed across the wire in either direction, and there would be a certain amount of good-humoured exchanges. Then a new bunch of men would arrive from across the bridge and stir up the crowd once more into a frenzy. By 8:30 that evening, it was getting dark, and it was perfectly obvious to Ronnie McAllister, Trevor Bedford and myself, the coolies had no intention whatsoever of pulling back without obtaining some major concession from us. Colonel McAllister and I were getting worried about the alertness of the small garrison of the police post, which was by now very tired and had had no food since midday. And I therefore telephoned the police military operations room in Hong Kong and asked permission to disperse the coolies back to their own side of the bridge using only such force as might be necessary. A quarter of an hour later, I was told that my request had been refused. It was the feeling at the police military headquarters in Hong Kong the coolies would so soon run out of steam and return home of their own accord for the night. I was asked what I thought would happen myself, and I replied, I'm not sure what will happen, but